Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. My name is James Gearing and this is episode 181. And I'm so excited to bring to you my next guest. We've been trying to make this happen for well over a year and we were finally able to sit down and record this. If you have seen the movie or read the book A Prayer Before Dawn, that was Billy's story. So Billy Moore is a fellow Brit. We talk about his early childhood. He found himself in prison in England, then got out of addiction, got clean, went traveling to Thailand, and then after another blip, he ended up in prison in Thailand. And that's what the movie and the book are mainly focusing on, and the nightmarish conditions, how he ultimately ended up fighting Muay Thai in this prison, and then how he was able to get back to the UK. So an incredible life story. Some extremely interesting insight into the effects of early trauma and the grasp of addiction and where it can send you. But I think a very, very powerful, inspiring story. And I was so glad that we were able to make it happen. So with that being said, as I always say, please go to your podcast apps, subscribe to the show, leave feedback. I love reading the feedback that you guys are leaving. And most importantly, share these incredible stories. And after that, make sure that you at least see the movie or read the book, A Prayer Before Dawn. And then when he releases it, Billy's new book will be coming out in a few months, and I'll make sure to post that as well. So with all that being said, I introduce to you Billy Moore. Enjoy. Billy, I just want to start by saying thank you so much for coming on the show. I know that we've been going back and forth for a while now, and having read the book and knowing your story, this is really, you know, a story I think that people should hear. So I want to just say thank you first for taking the time to speak to the audience.
Well, thank you. It's really nice to get the chance to speak to your audience regarding my story.
All right, brilliant. So I always start at the very, very beginning. So if you wouldn't mind, where were you born?
I was born in Liverpool, UK, England.
Brilliant. And then what was your family dynamic when you were young? What did your parents do and how many brothers and sisters did you have?
Well, there's six of us. I'm the oldest out of six. My dad, I've never known him to work. He drank a lot. The house was kind of very dysfunctional. There was a lot of violence. There was a lot of anger. My mum worked every hour, God sent. She done a lot of little jobs like working in pubs and little bits and bobs really just to make ends meet. And growing up, it was like, I don't think it was ever allowed to be a child really. I had to, as a caretaker, five other kids. It's with me all my other siblings really.
Yeah, so you were kind of like almost that father figure when you were a little bit older then.
Yeah. I grew up pretty quick on the streets of Liverpool.
Right, and then when you said your dad was an alcoholic, was there abuse within the firehouse? I mean, the firehouse, excuse me. Was there abuse within the household?
Yeah, that was subjected to a lot of, violence and kind of physical kind of beatings and name-calling. Never anything other than that, really.
Yeah, because the reason I like to always ask people about their early life is when, you know, we're going to talk about some things, obviously ending up in prison is kind of one of the cores of your story. But we as first responders, police and fire and EMS, we see these households with these young kids that are, you know, in these different states. And, you know, you go to some of these households, you're like, my God, how are these kids going to come out of this and function, you know, normally in society? Because some of these places are just, you know, horrendous. The kids have nothing. There's no food in the fridge. And yet, you know, there's the parents are taking care of themselves or they're drinking or they're on drugs. And, you know, we see that. And it's interesting talking to people like you where we see, you know, how that plays out further in life.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, now you put it that way, I can kind of paint a picture for you. You know, growing up in Liverpool, in the house that I was living in with my dad, the way he was, because he was a big man and it was quite intimidating. You know, he drank a lot, to be fair. I used to think that was normal, you know, but with drink came violence and anger and outbursts and there was no love in the household at all. You know, there was a lot of fear and I felt like this need to escape from my own home and spend time on the streets with groups of lads, and you know, and they were my peers, and you know, by standing on those corners, you know, I was kind of led down a different path. You know, my dad was a boxer, and I wanted to kind of impress him and prove to him that I could fight and, you know, gain his acceptance and his love and approval. No matter what I did, it kind of just fell flat on its face, basically. So, yeah, it was like I was scared. I was young. I felt really vulnerable. I had low self-esteem. You know, I remember getting my ear bit off when I was 14 years old, 14, 15, in a street fight. And that was like, that affected me massively as well, you know, like around girls and growing up. So there was a lot of stuff that impacted me youth as I grew up.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, you see that with, you know, it doesn't have to be a specific, you know, economic scale. It's not just the poor, but in a household where there isn't that father or mother figure, you know, raising their kids and showing them this is normal. Even to the kids that you see now, when you're coaching that mentor in the boxing gym, you know, these real men who are saying, look, this is how you conduct yourself. This is how you treat a woman. This is how you protect the weak. You know, if you don't have that, like you said, it's a free for all. And a lot of the kids, whether it's in England or America, find themselves in these gangs with the absolute worst role models.
Yeah, well, my first story that I wrote a play before Dawn, it was more brief on growing up, giving people like a brief introduction on my background and probably the way I was conditioned from an early childhood to become what I became. Whereas this second story kind of delves a little bit more into growing up. It delves into kind of like, you know, the way I felt in the household, the fear I was subjected to, having to watch my mother getting beat up on a regular basis, you know, hearing the screams and not being able to protect her because I was really small. And my mum said to me when I was about 9 years old one Christmas, what was you like? And I said, I want weights. And she looked at me like shocked and said, why would you want weights? Why wouldn't you want like a bike or, you know, a Millennium Falcon from Star Wars, because it was all that rage at the time. Because I feel like I need to be big and strong and protected. And I remember saying that. And that was something that really resonated with me for years. Not being able to kind of protect me mum and, you know, being in fear of being attacked and hurt. You know what I mean?
Yeah. When you worry, I mean, when you got a household full of kids and you know, you're being abused like that, then you're vulnerable. And like you said, that's fear ruling it. And at some point, you know, violence is going to play in. There's no question.
Yeah. So it definitely plays a big role in how it turns out. You know, I know we have choices and I know how to make decisions. And, you know, there's a lot of poor choices. I was conditioned to believe it was okay to do those things, because it's like monkey see, monkey do, that kind of attitude. You know, daddy is your role model. Your father's supposed to be a role model. And my mum, because there was so many of us, she had six of us in a short space of time, because she had six of us and six children within 8 years. So you can imagine her hands were full. And she never had the time to like be there for each and every one of us in that way. So it was quite difficult. So we never, there was that lack of love. Although I knew I was, it wasn't kind of intimate.
Yeah. Now, what age did you start boxing?
I started to box at the age of 13. I joined a club in speaking Liverpool called St. Ambrose ABC, which was then sponsored by a furniture company called Gemini. And I first decided to go, I joined a karate club, Shotokan.
I did show it again.
Yeah. Keon Kata, because it was all about Bruce Lee back in the day, and you know, it was Enter the Dragon and all that stuff. And so I was just kind of found myself doing that combat. I was never a team player, if that makes sense. You know what I mean? No one had ever passed me the ball in school.
Yeah, that does make sense if you see me when I was young.
So I felt independently, like, better off doing my own thing, really.
Yeah. Now, did you find any kind of mentors in the karate dojo or the boxing gym when you were younger?
Not so much the karate, but in boxing, you know, I had a good trainer. He took his time with me, and you know, I learned to kind of box pretty quick. You know, and within a few months of learning, I was in the ring, fighting and competing.
Right, and what was your boxing career like? I mean, what were your accolades?
I think he had about 16 fights, and I've lost about 4. I won my first 5 on the run, and then I lost my 6th in Ireland, and then it kind of affected me confidence. You know, and I lost a couple on the run then because I felt like, whoa, you know what I mean? I was on top of the world at first, and then all of a sudden, I'm getting beat. And that's what happened. And then after about 16 fights, you know, during the summer holidays, or the breaks from the boxing shows, you know, stand on the corners away from the home. You know, one thing led to another, you know, drinking, then it became drugs. And then snowballed quickly into addiction.
Right, and with the boxing, like you said, you got the weights and you wanted to protect your mum. Did you find you went from the vulnerable kid to almost the bully because you suddenly realized that you were powerful and you were able to inflict violence now?
No, I think it came become more of someone who wouldn't, it was sick and tired of being sick and tired and wouldn't tolerate. You know, I was definitely kind of against people who bullied. I remember writing this in my first story. I was like a rebel without a cause. I was always like being the underdog's corner. You know, after watching it and witnessing it and being subjected to it, it was something that I didn't like.
Yeah. Actually, I was talking to someone yesterday about that, the concept of violence. You know, people think, well, the answer is to not be violent at all. And I think that the answer is actually to be capable of violence so you can protect the weak, but not always resort to it if you can get around it. But if you're not a threat to the bully, then you're not going to be able to deter them from being a bully in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I always felt I was quite... I just stands up for myself, you know. It got to a point where, you know, I never ever went looking for it. I was never one of those kids who wanted to just scrap with everyone. It was always like, if it came to me, then yeah, you know, it happened, and I wouldn't tolerate it or accept it.
Yeah. All right. So then you were talking about getting into addiction. Was that what led you to your first stint in prison?
Yeah, definitely. You know, it was a downhill spiral. You know, picked up a drug from an early age, and it was, you know, within a matter of months, I was using Class A's. I was committing crimes to fund the habit that I'd developed. You know, I was doing things that I didn't want to do. You know, and I was going to places that I didn't want to go. And, you know, and I felt myself isolated and separated from society. You know, I was bringing shame on my family. I was bringing shame on myself. I had no integrity. You know, all my morals and my principles and my values had gone out the window. My drugs became more important than anyone else. You know, I became a monster. You know, and I was driven by something more powerful than me, and I couldn't stop no matter what. If you put me in a cell, and I could pass a lie detector test, I'd never do it again. I really believed in it, you know, because I wanted it so much. And then I'd get back out, and within seconds, I was, you know, I that choice was taken away from me as soon as I picked up again. You know, I think it'll be different this time. You know, I'll try and do something. You know that, like, we repeat the same mistake and expect a different result, and it was just a ball of insanity. Well, that's what was happening, and then it wasn't until like years later that I understood that I had no awareness, and there was no education, and there was no support, and there was no guidance in them times. It was just like, here's a key and here's a door, we're going to shut it and we'll open you when you finish your sentence, and that was it. And that's how it was for a long time.
What was the initial drug that really got you in trouble?
The first one was, I'd say it started with the gateway drug, cannabis, and then it led straight on to heroin and crack cocaine.
Right. Now, because excuse me, that's something that I see from the outside looking in. Obviously, I haven't ever been in prison, and I'm observing both, you know, back home in England and here now in America. But it seems like the way that we've done this, I'll just put it that way, the way that we're doing prison, the way that we're viewing drugs and addiction doesn't seem to be working, because we keep churning the, you know, these men and women out, and then they go back to their addiction, and they're back in prison. It's this vicious circle, the revolving door. Without loading the question, what was the addiction help that you had both inside and outside, you know, when you were trying to kick the habit?
Absolutely nothing. It was just, I'll give you a prescription to get off drugs and give you different drugs to come off the drugs that you're on. So all that it became was a vicious cycle of like using different substances, different drugs to come off drugs. There was never any identification. There was never any, it was prescription drugs that they give you. It was no help. And prison was like, you know, there was never no help there either at all. So I couldn't really, hands on heart, say that there was any support. Maybe there'd be like, I don't know, someone telling me to get me shit together, and that was about as good as it got.
Yeah. Because, I mean, again, what a great example of how they're doing it well, and I'll be very brief because people have heard this, you know, several times now. But in Portugal, back in 2000, they decriminalized drugs as far as an addict, not selling, not smuggling, but the addicts themselves. And so they became patients instead of criminals. So if you come in and you're arrested and you're found in possession of a personal amount, then you get filtered through an addiction program where they have addiction help and psychological therapy and job creation and all these things. And they've literally reversed their epidemic in Portugal from the worst in Europe to the best. And that's what I'm seeing is, if we're just locking up our addicts, and then, you know, obviously I'm sure in prison the addiction is probably terrible as well, as we see certainly in later in your story, but you're not treating why these men and women are drinking, why they're taking drugs, maybe even, you know, why they're violent, which is the underlying trauma, and you're never ever going to kick that until that's taken care of, that's addressed. And if we're not dealing with those issues in or out of prison, either way, it should be both, then we're never going to fix this addiction.
Yeah, and I agree with you. There's a lot of underlying kind of contributing factors to why people use. However, they've, you know, it's, and I'm speaking from experience, for years and years, probably, you know, people were kind of trying to help me and offer me support and guidance, but I wasn't ready to or willing to listen at that stage because I was just kind of blocking out all these demons that would torment me, you know, I'd rip my soul apart every evening, and I couldn't face reality on a daily basis, so I kind of want to block it out. It was only when, you know, the drugs couldn't do that for me no more that I had to surrender from the art and go, you know what, I need to kind of just put my hands up and go, I can't do this no more, this is beating me. It's like getting in the boxing ring, coming out back in blue, and then, you know, getting back in again, and you're still getting beat. You know, sometimes they go, look, we're going to throw the towel in, Bill. You ain't going to win this competition. But you just keep getting back in day after day after day with a gorilla. And you're thinking, you know what, I'm not going to win this. And then it comes to a time and you go, okay, hands up, that's it.
Yeah. Well, especially if you're using the same strategy each time, you keep getting beaten instead of reimagining that strategy where maybe you'll overcome it.
Yeah, definitely.
Right. Well, I'd love to kind of transition into Thailand. So what initially took you to Thailand back in, was it 2005? Is that right?
2005, correct. What happened, what initially took me there?
Yeah.
It was years of being incarcerated in prisons in the UK, using drugs. So I finally kind of made that decision that something had to change, and I went into a rehabilitation program. And I asked, it was me, put my hands up, said, look, I need help. And the minute he asked for help, it came. That's what I'm trying to say. You've got to be willing at that stage, you know what I mean? And came in the form of a rehab in Bristol in 2004. I got myself clean, I got myself involved in recovery, became aware of my addiction. You know, and then I got a passport, a bank account. Things started to come into my life. And then I was invited to go to Thailand for, it was a 12 week backpacking holiday that turned into a 5 year nightmare, basically.
Well, just touching on Bristol for a second. So was there a specific event that made you put your hands up and say, I'm ready now?
Yeah, I climbed on a prison roof in Walton, in Liverpool, HMP Walton. And it was a negative way of asking for help, to be honest. You know, and he put me in solitary confinement for over 7 months. I got a few punches, a few kicks, nothing that I didn't expect. But it was at that time when I was in that solitary confinement for that amount of time that, you know, there was no drugs in my body. You know, couldn't access any. I started to think about, like, my future, you know, and my past, and, you know, the harms I'd done to people, and, you know, all the guilt and shame kicked in, and, you know, then I wanted to change. It was like, you know what, I phoned my mum, and I said, Mum, I couldn't even speak to my mum. I remember picking up the phone, and my mum spoke to me, and I couldn't answer because just hearing the voice, you know, I had a lump in my throat and tears in my eyes, and I was afraid to blink, and there was two, you know, prison officers standing next to me. And I thought, I can't show any vulnerability in front of these. And she just knew, she just said, son, get some help. I know you need it. And that's what I did. I went back to Michelle and I wrote a letter. I sat down and asked for help.
That's amazing. It's funny because that's not the, you know, the intervention that you would think, solitary confinement, but being forced to be there with your own thoughts and have to basically face your demons there, whether you like it or not. It was a very powerful moment for you.
Yeah, no matter what people said or tried to do, it was like I had to really sit there and be alone with them. And, you know, and the thoughts that came through the back door of my mind uninvited were really unsavory and, you know, wasn't very pleasant. And, you know, it was forced to suicide. It was forced to, like, ending it and, you know, depression and mental health. And it was quite difficult at that time of my life. You know, the guy next door to me, hung himself.
Oh, God.
And I thought, I was speaking to him 10 minutes before he did. And we were, you know, and I was just like, just life was so kind of like, there was no value in it, you know what I mean? People just died, and it was like, you know, I thought, oh, I need to get something shorter there. And that's what happened. That was my intervention, was my mum kind of just saying, look, stop fighting. Just ask for help, son. You need it. She knew. She just knew. I didn't even have to respond on the phone. She just knew. I was afraid to answer because at that time I was quite sad and quite hurt, and bang, you know, it clicked into place, and that was my intervention.
And what did the treatment look like in the facility in Bristol?
It was a 12-step program, and it was group therapy, people challenging each other's behaviours. I was very kind of like angry at the time because I felt their using was a tea party compared to mine. I was comparing myself to their background and, you know, judging, and I was in despair with it all. And I always felt it was different, and I'd separate myself pretty quickly. And, you know, it was something, you know, that I learned that was called denial. I was in denial about, you know, me own problems because I felt I was unique. When we sat down and I discussed with other people, and then it was identifying with their similar kind of problems, it was, I realised that I wasn't alone, and that I wasn't unique, and that I wasn't separate and different from the rest of society, that, you know, I was just a crazy mixed up kid, you know, from a two-bit town, struggling with life on life's terms.
Yeah, that's something that we see a lot now in my, you know, profession, the police and the fire and the EMS, where a few years ago, if you said you were struggling, you know, with the PTSD or, you know, whatever was going on, your addiction, you know, no one would reach out. And we're getting all these suicides and, you know, all these horrible things happening because they would look at everyone else and think, everyone else is doing fine. I'm the weak one, you know, so I'm just going to stop being a burden and end it. And now finally people are realizing, no, that's bullshit. It's a facade. Everyone's hurting in some way, shape or form.
Yeah. Can I just say something right, James? Because I was quite angry. I had an interview with some national TV reporter, and she was saying, "Oh, you know, how come you're in prison, and how can you know, why did you do what you did? You've got an international best-selling book, and there's a movie about your life. Why are you here? What went wrong? I don't understand." And I'm like, do you know anything about addiction? Have you ever looked in the dictionary and looked at the definition of what addiction is? You know, when you're driven by something, and it's easy for people to go, yeah, you know, who haven't had that experience and go, nah, he had a choice. Well, your choice is taken away when you've got something in back, inside you that just won't stop. You know, it's like the four horsemen are just taking you to the very depths of hell. I'm trying to like explain to this person who's quite close-minded, and it was quite like it was angering me because I thought, do you think I woke up one morning and I want to have a career and committing crime and taking drugs and spending the rest of my life in prison? Do you think I've got this fantasy about you know, a great life? And you know, yeah, I just couldn't get the fact that she couldn't understand, and probably because she hasn't experienced this. So that's where, you know, there's no justifying, there's no blame, there's no rationalizing, there's no minimizing anything other than the fact that, like, addiction kind of takes everything out. It robs everything. I mean, it robs your sanity, it robs your morals, your principles, you know, your moral compass. Everything goes, and it's sad. You know, you're talking to a guy now that hasn't used for quite some time. You know, and I wouldn't be doing the things that I've did or that I've done in the past. You with me?
Yeah.
I'm quite like, you know, I've got sound clear in mind, and you know, I don't blame myself for what my addiction did. I take responsibility for my recovery today. Okay, so I kind of like look and go, okay, so what harms have I done, and how can I make amends? And that's what I do. You know, I'm not gonna beat myself up for years and you know, carry a cross and nail myself to it every time someone says anything. I've had enough of that. You know what I mean? It's like, this is like what sends people back out there, and what people struggle with, the mental health and all that illnesses. You know what I mean? It's like, look, let's encourage people, let's build up the character, let's work with them, let's show them that there's a way out. And that's what I'm about today, to be fair.
Yeah, well, then that's exactly it. Is I get sick of them. I see that, you know, in some of the calls I run and some of the people I work with occasionally, there's normally some very, very good people. But, you know, looking down their nose at someone, if they're an addict, if they're a prostitute, if they're homeless, so, you know, whatever, you know, element that we think is beneath us, instead of going, well, and I always say this, we all grew up, like, if you and me and, you know, a prostitute and whoever else were all in a daycare, we'd just be laughing and chasing a ball. Like you said, none of us said, oh, well, one day I'm going to live under a bridge, or I'm going to sell my body, or, you know, whatever it is. That's the path that life took you. And yeah, of course, you have decisions and, you know, you can make them, especially, you know, hopefully when you have that realization and you look back. But I was fortunate enough to grow up in Bath, just outside Bristol, on a farm. And my dad was a vet, and both my parents were there, and I had no challenges. So my thing is, because I've had the path that I've led, then it's my duty to reach my hand and help everyone else try and, you know, come up that wasn't gifted that idyllic childhood. So if you didn't go down that rocky road, now you're looking down your nose at people because they're an addict, or, you know, anything else that you think is beneath you, then you need to check yourself and realize that you were blessed and you're on this earth to help the people that weren't find their way back, and then they in turn can help other people.
Yeah, definitely. I like the way you put that, yeah.
that's how I feel.
And that's a great way to kind of put it across, because it's having empathy and understanding, and because some people will judge you, and you know what, for those that want to judge me, there's a queue. You know, I'm in the front of it, so you can get to the back. You know, I'm not really that forced on that, to be fair. And I'm not here to kind of like judge anyone else, because I've got no right to.
No, and judging doesn't do anything anyway. Nothing gained from judging, you know what I mean? So, but all right, well, I want to take us back to Thailand. So when you came out of Bristol, you were clean, you were doing really well, you were going to do the backpack trip in Thailand. So what did those, you know, that initial time in Thailand look like? And I know you worked on the movie set, and then if you wouldn't mind just kind of walking us through how that took a turn again.
Okay, initially got to Thailand and I was like a world-class card-carrying pleasure seeker. You know, I felt like I'd been reborn. I was clean, I was in recovery, and it was a new world, and I was like a child again. I was excited at the opportunity to kind of go traveling with a friend. You know, I wanted to relive my old dreams of boxing and join this boxing camp in Thailand, and you know, got in the ring and started competing in Muay Thai competitions, which he enjoyed. Got the chance to work with Sylvester Stallone on the last Rambo movie, and he's a great guy. You know, it's like he's a very very intelligent a man who's my hero growing up. Really, I used to love Rocky, and I was just over the moon to actually get the chance to work with him. And that was panning out, and then I got a job teaching English. So things seem to be, you know, on the outside, we're going really, really well. Boxing, acting, traveling, you know, living the dream. And underneath it all, I just couldn't cope with relationships. It was, you know, I was quite immature emotionally. And I remember meeting someone, and she was a beautiful kind of Thai girl. And the conversation was just a dictionary between us. And I couldn't understand the words she said. And I found out that somehow had another boyfriend. Another boyfriend by this, you know what I mean? And I quite got quite hurt by it, really. And she was like, you know, why are you sad? And I thought, well, in England, it's me and you, and that's how it is. It's not me, you, and your geek. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So-called. And, you know, I couldn't deal with stuff. And, you know, the pain and the heartache was really too much for me to take. You know, I didn't even know this girl. I can't even blame her, to be honest. It was just at that time I was attached to these feelings. You could put me in the ring and I could box and I could take punches all day and kicks and bruises and cuts, and you could put plasters and bandages all over that. But on the internal stuff, it was like I couldn't deal with it. It was like, wow. So I found myself in the ring trying to escape the pain a lot, fighting every night. And then when I was outside that ring, it was real life, and it was life on life terms, and then I felt the pain of it all, you know, until eventually I picked up a drink because it was that painful, you know. And I remember screaming inside, this isn't the answer, you know what's gonna happen, you know. And it was like that battle within, and then I just thought, fuck it, man, I'm just gonna drink it. I hope you don't mind me emphasizing a few swear words here.
No, this is explicit show. You're fine.
But I can be myself.
Yes.
No, but, I was thinking, oh, fuck this, man. I'm just gonna go for it and see if everything kind of I can do it differently. And that drink just led me to going to Burma, buying China White, scoring Yaba tablets, which is methamphetamine, and the crystal meth, and taking drugs that I'd never even took before, taking addiction to another level in a foreign country. You know, and I was involved in dealing low-level kind of bits of tablets to friends that I'd met over in Thailand to support me habit and finance it. There's an ultimate consequence when you do that type of stuff. You end up in them type of places, and I got arrested. And then that was taking my life to another kind of a level on its own. thought prison in the UK was terrible, but then, you know, I got incarcerated in Thailand.
Yeah, now the irony was you weren't caught for the dealing, were you? It was actually something else.
It was just the mobile phone I was arrested for. It was a handle on a stolen mobile phone, if you can believe that. I had all, it was when he came to my room, there was, all kinds of weapons and drugs. And I secreted them quickly. No drugs were found. All the weapons were confiscated anyway. I wasn't even charged with any. And one of them was a gun as well. And I was quite confused because I thought that's what they'll charge me with. And I didn't realise that, you know, I think the maximum penalty for carrying a firearm over there was 9 months and everyone and his dog had a gun anyway. It wasn't like over here. You know, and the phones, he had a load of mobile phones, because it was changing my SIM cards and I was paranoid and I was buying them off drug dealers and I was buying them off, you know, drug addicts who were scoring off me. And that's what happened. One of these phones had been classed as stolen by someone, so it was handling stolen property. And he gave me 3 years for that, can you believe it?
Huh. Now, if you've been found with the drugs, I know Thailand's got a low tolerance for drug smuggling. Would that have been even worse, a sentence?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. I'm just grateful that I didn't get arrested with drugs on me, because I would have ended up with at least a 20-year sentence.
So then let's talk about that. So I want to go back just for a second. So just to highlight that too, you'd been doing so well being clean, but it's interesting because you see, I've heard, you know, people that I've had on here before. One of my good friends, Chad, who alcohol was his main thing, and he was a fireman. So when he became a fireman, he was clean and he threw himself into his job and he was doing, you know, just the ultimate fireman stuff with the special ops and all these different areas where he could keep himself busy. But it was the same kind of thing. Like, there came a point where all that healthy stuff wasn't filling the void and that addiction crept back. And it seems like, you know, what you're saying, going not just from a drink to going on a complete bender again, how that was the same thing. Like, it just crept in and then flew open the door of Pandora's box.
Yeah, I go straight back to me drug of choice. You know, I don't kind of like find myself standing in public houses or boozers and just having a drink and going home at the end of the night. I'm hitting the ground hard. I don't know why. There's something within me that just says, look, let's go and destroy yourself. Let's go and self-destruct. Let's create as much harm as humanly possible to yourself and others. I think, oh my God, this is a monster that kind of like arrives from within. It's just, wants to just fuck up everything that is good in my life. It's just, yeah. And it's just, you know, grateful that I'm not, you know, in that world anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about the Thai world then. I mean, you know, I read the book a while ago now, you know, before we were talking, and then saw the movie, which we'll talk about in a little bit, which I think it does a very good, immersion for the viewer on a snapshot of what you went through. But what was that first night? I mean, I know you write about that in the book, the very first time when you were taken into the Thai jail. Just tell me about that experience.
I remember getting on a bus, it was just absolutely ram full of inmates with shackles on, and they all wore brown canvas suits. You know, because I was initially arrested, I didn't have to kind of wear that stuff to get transported. But, you know, as time went on, and I had to go to and fro court, I was experiencing the same kind of outfits they were. You know, I walked in, and I was just wrapped up in fear, and I was trying to act tough, but I was scared at the same time. The language barrier was difficult, so I couldn't communicate. I remember going for they asked us to get a shower in this trough, you know, and there was about 100 of us that came through the gates that night. And it was a thick film of, like, dirt on the water, and it was cold. You know, and we were all washing together, no soap, just throwing water over us, strip shirts. You know, and then sat down in groups of four to eat this bowl of sticky rice with a bowl of kind of, you know, I couldn't even describe what it was, and it was stinking. and I just couldn't stomach it. I was like going into the compound, and he put us into a cell, and I just thought, what's going on here? It looked like a mass grave. There was arms and legs on the floor everywhere. You know, it just stunk to high heaven of feces, and, you know, let's say what it is. It stunk as shit, you know what I mean? You know, and urine and vomiting, you know, there was abscesses on people's legs with bloodstained bandages wrapped around them and virtually no space, and it was absolutely hot. You know, you can picture this. And I walked in and I just thought, the fuck am I coming here? What's going on? I mean, I got put in this little part of the shell next to a ladyboy called Tiffany, I remember, you know, because she spoke to me immediately, you know, and introduced herself and pointed at the guy next to me and said, he's dead, you know. And I thought, oh, why won't he move him? He said, well, he can't because it's a holiday. And I thought, fucking hell, it was just so sad, really, you know what I mean? And I just lay there all night, just wide awake, just looking at the ceiling, looking around the shell, just watching this massive body, just kind of like moving up and down as they slept. That was my first night.
And how long was it till they took that poor guy that passed away from there?
2 days.
Oh my God.
2 days, because it was a Thai holiday.
That's insane. So then, did you, you know, those first few weeks, were you able to find, you know, a group like you would in maybe in other prisons?
No. I was on my own for a long time in the beginning. Like you said earlier on, I was like a rebel without a cause, you know, couldn't mix with foreigners. There was a few Australians and Iranian and, you know, an Indian and a few other guys, but it was just Jeff, and it was just definitely different from me. And you weren't my cup of tea, to be honest. I just couldn't relate with them, you know. And
he says some of them were kiddie fiddlers, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't be able to relate to them either.
Yeah, there was definitely, the ties, you knew what most of them were in for. It was either drugs or robbery or something like that, you know what I mean? The foreigners, there was a few, you know, there was a few that were in for like fraud and stuff like that and drugs, you know, and bits and bobs. And then you got the odd, well, quite a few that were doing a lot of other things, you know what I mean, which I just wanted to rip someone's windpipe out one day and just think, you know what, you fucking need to die, you know what I mean, for what you've done.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why, it's just, it was over here in the UK, they'd lock you up and separate you from everyone else, but over there it was just, no one give a shit. Absolutely give two fucks what they did. That was wrong.
Yeah, it's strange how it's, you know, how there's that different in culture, because I know, you know, being British myself, you know, we hear about a lot of these Brits that would go over there for that reason, you know, to go to Thailand just so they can do that with kids that they know they would get, you know, hung up to do if they tried it in England.
Yeah, loads of sex tourists, you know. It was, and I met one guy, you know, and his name's Jack, and he's in my story, and, you know, he's gay, and, you know, I've got nothing against anyone who's, anyone's gender or anyone's kind of sexuality. It was just the fact that he was picking up vulnerable, like, Burmese village boys and stuff like that. So, you know, and he was the only English guy there, you know, and I nicknamed him Prozac Jack because all he ever done was say Prozac, and he was just, yeah, solely depressed and with it all, and, you know, played the victim, and, you know, and the kid was lying and stuff like that. But, you know, the truth came out in the end. So, yeah, and then there was another guy from Australia who was in for raping a 2-year-old girl, and I had to share a shell with him, and the thoughts that were going through my mind about what I wanted to do to him, you know, I should be locked up for murder, to be honest. And it was, it, you know, the force, that's exactly what they were, murderous. And I just couldn't do nothing. And it wasn't for me to do anything, to be honest. It wasn't my place. You know, I'm not judge and jury, and you know, I'm not going to put myself on the line for someone else. But this is what I'm trying to paint a picture of how I felt. They were feelings, they weren't actions, if that makes sense.
No, it does. It does. I mean, like you said, you're the protector. So there you are in a cell with someone who's abused children. I mean, that's yeah. You know, if you do something to them, that it's just going to, you know, end up keeping you in that prison longer.
If I even had attacked them or being verbally abusive to them, I'd have been put in something called what they call a soy, in a punishment block. And I'd experienced that in the first prison I'd been to in Chiang Mai. And I didn't like it. You know, I felt like I wanted to end my life when I was in there. I learned pretty quick not to repeat the same mistakes there because, you know, it was very, very unhealthy. So, yeah, I think they knew that and I knew that. So they just became ghosts to me, to be honest. That's how I kind of treated people. So that's why I spent a lot of time on my own and, you know, drugs came back into play again. They became my friends and my only companions for a while.
Yeah, now, you talk about this in the book as well. Obviously, you weren't walking in with a wallet full of cash. So what were the challenges trying to feed your addiction in there?
Oh, I had to beg, borrow and steal. You know, I had missionaries coming up. You know, they'd buy you food and the food that they bought me, I'd sell. You know, the British Embassy were supplying us with vitamin tablets and protein tablets, and I'd sell them. Prisoners abroad would send 2,000 baht every month and I'd spend that on drugs. You know, I'd get medication and swap the medication for drugs. I had nothing, you know, and that's how I kind of got by. You know, and I couldn't afford to pay some of the debts and I'd end up fighting and, you know, and it just became that way of life, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, that's such a great kind of example or illustration though of what addiction is like, that you're getting this stuff sent to you, for example, you know, the food. I mean, the food's awful and you get the opportunity to buy something better or, you know, cigarettes or whatever it is. And all that you're just turning back so you get yaba or, you know, whatever you were getting your hands on. If that doesn't illustrate how powerful addiction is, I don't know what does.
Yeah, that's where I'm trying to, like, where I come from before. You know, it's got such a power over you that, like, you would sell your soul for just one more.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the upturn then. So how did you find Muay Thai in prison itself?
Well, there was a boxing camp in the prison and training, you know, a lot of people were training, and I was, because of the fights I was getting involved in just in the normal population, and the guard came over and said, look, Bill, you're like the Oscar De La Hoya, this prison, you're going to end up getting killed the way you're going on. You know, it's like, it's not one-on-one, there's a few attacking you and you just keep coming back the next day and doing it again, and you know, I was just sick of seeing you really like this. So he encouraged me to join this boxing team. We were quite unreasonable. Really. Like, they were kind of like, they weren't like allowing me to get in. I had to bribe them with cigarettes. In the end, they gave me the chance to come and train with them, and they just let me be. And they seen that I had a few skills and that they could kind of exploit that opportunity to bet against other Thai boxers with me involved and make a little bit of money. And that's how it began, really. And then I became friends. And, you know, that journey of, like, unity and collectively as a group, the boxing team and myself as one.
Yeah, it's you know, interesting, again, how when you were young, you know, boxing was your outlet. And now here you are a lot older, but back in that place where you can focus your energy and your aggression and then, you know, build that tribe around you, that camaraderie of the other fighters. Yeah. From the outside looking in, seems like it was a good healing outlet for you that offset some of the need to fill the void with the drugs.
Yeah, definitely.
So then what about the fights? I mean, how successful were you against the Muay Thai fighters?
Pretty damn good, I think. Yeah. I'm not stroking my own ego trying to elevate myself with that one. I remember getting in the ring and, you know, I could take physical pain all day, you know, and I knew they couldn't box like I boxed. They were great at kicking and that, and I learned how to defend myself pretty quick. So I was up against it, you know, they put me in with a few tough customers, but I stood my ground and, you know, I won a few and I lost a few. I never won them all. And I don't claim to be someone who's, you know, a championship, new side boxer at any sets, but, you know, I've got heart. I knew I had that. And I wouldn't give up. And it was quite, yeah. I thought, this is it, come on, this is my turf here. Let's get in the ring. I'll show you a few moves.
Yeah, because the Muay Thai, I mean, I love Muay Thai. I've trained myself for you know, several years, and not as a fighter, though. Let me be very clear. I'm not the punch bag that the fighters beat up in, when they're training for a fight. But I can see how, if you come from Thailand, how if you're a British boxer coming in, that your hand skills would be hard for a traditional Muay Thai fighter to deal with.
Yeah, that's what they were up against. They were up against fast left jabs, slipping, sliding, ducking and diving, bobbing and weaving, and right crosses. I was up against elbows, knees, and bear hugs.
Yeah, normally when you're clinching in a boxing match, you're separated by the referee, not so much in Muay Thai.
No, they were throwing knees in, so I learned to kind of keep a distance, but, you know, there's pretty heavy-duty kicks to the back of the legs and, you know, the neck and elbows to the top of my eyes and on the bridge of my nose. So it took a few clouts, like.
Right, so then you, in the book, you talk about the accident that you had before you went to prison and then how that manifested itself once you were in there. And I think that's a kind of interesting story to touch on as well. So the surgery that you had to have done.
Yeah, I'd come off a motorbike when I was in Lao. It was just, I went from driving on one side of the road to going into another country and not realising that they drove on the other side. I was hit by two taxis, like tuk-tuk taxis, that smashed the bike in half. Basically, that went on the air and the brake lever went through my stomach and the chassis landed on my chest, crushing my ribs, punching in my lung, you know, caused me a lot of internal kind of problems within my stomach area. I got stitched up in a hospital in Lao and then sent back to Chiang Mai, Thailand. I spent 3 months in hospital before I went into prison. I was in hospital. You know, so we had surgery twice while I was in a prison in Thailand. And that was affecting me getting in the ring again. I refused to kind of not, like, give up. And they were asking me, look, it's not going to really be good for you to do this anymore. And I thought, nah. If I'm going to die, I'm going to die fighting, in that sense. I'm not going to lie down and just take it.
And when you were in one of the hospitals, you actually made it out of the hospital, didn't you? You had the opportunity to escape. I'm really intrigued about this. What made you turn around and go back?
I remember. You know what? I remember getting, I think it was 1,000 baht off Catherine, the missionary, and he had these chains on me, the elephant chains, and they put these bandages around them, you know, because they were rattling a lot, and he didn't want to upset the rest of the patients. And then the sarong around me, so it was covering, like, it was hiding it. And this guard, he lazy fucker, honest to God, he just didn't, like, hang around all day long and just keep his eye on me. He used to say, I'll be back at his break or whatever, and put a gun to his head and said, if you run, I'll shoot you or whatever. To that. And I remember, like, with this 1,000 baht, and I wanted a cigarette, and I had no money. I had no cigarettes, and I had this money. And I found the exit, went down the exit. It's the first time. And I opened the bottom door, and outside was all people on grass, having, like, a picnic, eating food. No visitors to the families, really, you know what I mean? In the hospital grounds. Got myself a cigarette and I walked over to the to the 7-Eleven and bought a bottle of brandy and 20 cigarettes, Cruntic cigarettes, and then went next door and bought 500 Tramadol tablets. And I came back, I was scared, like, I was actually kind of fearful, and I was like, whoa, this is I'm outside, and, you know, I'm actually in the street, you know, and then I made it back to the hospital, back up the fire exit stairs, and back into bed. And my confidence grew over the days, because I used to go down the back of the stairs every single night for a cigarette at the time. And then one night when the tablets ran out, I made this crazy kind of decision to make a run for it. And I left my bed at about 1 a.m. And by 3 a.m. I was walking around these streets thinking to myself, where the fuck are you going to go here? You've got shackles on your ankles. You can't steal a motorbike. You can't steal a car. Where are you going to go anyway? All these keep like playing around in my mind. You can't get the embassy. They'll just send you back. If you get caught, you'll probably get shot. If you go and approach any tight nationals, they'll probably blow you up and grass you up and get you put. You know what I mean? So I had all this to contend with. And then eventually just found myself walking back, just deflated, thinking, it's only 3 years.
That's amazing. So let's talk about how you finally got out then, because, you know, that in itself is a pretty incredible story. So you're going through hell. I mean, you're now obviously fighting Muay Thai, but you still got the, you know, the violence and the death and the shitty food and the overcrowding and all these other things. So what was the turning point where you realized, okay, I am actually going to get to go home at some point?
I think as the sentence was coming to an end, I never had like a release date. You know, and I heard about that there was a repatriation possible, and I asked the embassy to support that, and, you know, they put in a form or whatever they had to do. They came back about 3 or 4 months later, said, look, okay, we'll repat you back to the UK. And that was, it was like a wow moment. I'd been in Thailand for 5 years by this time. You know, I'd built up a relationship with these people, these Thai friends that I had, and they all came to the gate and, you know, to see me off, and it was quite sad. It was a moment, and, you know, and I felt for the first time that I was leaving something behind, and I was leaving friends that, I'd made whilst I was there. And it did take a long time, and, you know, because I changed by this stage. I was off drugs, and I was involved in a lot of the religious stuff at the time, from that helped. So, yeah, that's where I felt really about it.
See, that's just so, it's so crazy that, I mean, I guess that shows you how everything that we deal with in life is between our two ears, because externally, you know, what you went through in that prison, what your fellow prisoners were going through as well, was compared to, you know, life on most of the world, pretty awful. But that friendship that you ended up discovering, you know, overcame all the other stuff.
Mm, it did, yeah.
So, and what about the addiction? What was it that really got you off the drugs in prison?
I think it was just the fact that I'd ran out of money, I'd ran out of choices, I'd ran out of friends, my life was being threatened on a daily basis. I was subjected to threats of death by, you know, HIV infected syringes, rape. Was on the cards if I didn't pay bills, apparently. And the fact that, like, I was so fucking lonely in it all that I just couldn't cope. And I just kind of made this decision to stop. And, you know, these Muslim guys helped me. Quite weird, really. They invited me to eat some lunch with them, and they spoke about unity and support, and collectively as a group, you know, they take care of me, and not in a way that it was like they were kind of like jihad, so they wanted me to be involved in some kind of extreme Muslim kind of far right group, you know what I mean? They just wanted to show me a way of living, like without using. And he said, if you join our religion, that's what he said, you know, there's a few rules. You can't have sex with men. Oh, that's okay. Don't do that.
That's going to be a tough one. All right.
That's confusion. He says you can't take drugs. And I like the idea of not taking drugs. Mm-hmm. He sold it to me and we'll feed you. So, you know, they knew that I wasn't a Muslim. And they knew I was blagging it, but he didn't kind of turn me away.
See, that's so good to hear, because I'm sure you have the same in England, but, you know, we hear so much negativity about Islam, and that's just those, you know, that minute percentage of shitbags that are doing horrible things in the name of Islam.
Yeah,
but
definitely.
What you're talking about is the, you know, the good people in that faith.
Yeah, see, what I got portrayed to believe that they were doing, you know, my marriage was all what I'd read in the papers and what I'd been told from secondhand you know, conversations about. And I sat there one day and said, I'm going to ask a few questions because I'm not really too fussy with your firm, you know what I mean? So what's it with all these backpacks? And that's how naive I was, you know what I mean? And I thought, everyone who's got a backpack is going to blow everything up. And he went, say, look, Bill, started laughing. He said, look, you know, Islam means peace, he said. And there's people that are out there that kind of like, that don't want peace. And jihad means, you know, to fight within, not to fight other people. You know, As-salamu alaykum means, you know, has two meanings. It means peace be with you, and also I'm not going to harm you, my friend. And I kind of liked the way they kind of spoke about it, you know what I mean? And I watched them for a long time before I sat with them, and I seen the integrity that they had, and I seen the way they behaved, and, you know, it was quite nice, and it was quite serene, and you know, and I wanted a bit of kind of like normality. That's all I think I gravitated towards, that where everyone else was doing their own thing. And it was nice to have that, you know, that way of life for a short time, a short period of being in there before I got released.
Yeah, and what were those guys in prison for themselves?
Murder, drug dealing, them likes, really, you know what I mean?
And had they discovered Islam after that, or were they always Muslim and they just found their way down a bad path as well?
Yeah, they were just bad Muslims.
Right.
That's what they used to say. We're just like, you don't even go to Juma on a Friday, Bill. We're just a bit of a bad Muslim at the minute. So, you know, we made mistakes. You know, they were honest. They were open.
Yeah. No, but that's good. And like you were saying, you know, we all make mistakes and you can't dwell in the past. And you see that a lot in America for some reason, where a lot of prisoners come from, you know, wherever, and they find a faith, whether it's Christianity, Islam, whatever it is. And you know, that's the ones you see that many times become mentors and become good people, and then leave prison and start mentoring, you know, the gang kids and trying to get them to change their ways. So, and it all boils down to me, like, you know, again, you're either a good person or a bad person, and whatever you can use to make yourself good and spread that kindness is good. It doesn't matter what it's called.
Yeah, man. I agree.
All right. Well, then let's talk about the transition. So you were in this great group. You found your spirituality. You know, you had this group of people. You were clean. What was that transition back from Thailand back to England again?
It was a culture shock. It was very, very difficult. I'd learned a new language and I'd adopted a new culture, and then I was thrown back into the UK penal system, and it was frightening. You know, I felt really vulnerable, and there was definitely no support or no help when I got back. I got released from Wandsworth Prison in London with a bag with a few belongings in it and a travel warrant. And I stood rooted to the spot outside the prison gates going, they didn't even tell me it was getting released. They just opened the door and, you know, this is it, you know. And I was just like, what the fuck's going on here? Where am I going to go? I don't even know anyone. Felt too embarrassed to go home and speak to my mum and my family because of my journey had been on, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's what strikes me as you know, something that we could do better. And again, I'm not saying that we don't need, you know, incarceration and punishment, all that stuff, because obviously we do. But there's a gentleman I had on the show from Norway, who's from a governor from a prison out there. And what they do in this particular one is when you're in prison, you live in a town. It's on an island off Oslo, but it's called Bastøy. And you live with other prisoners and you cook and you clean and you go, you have a job that you go to every day and you can learn trades. So by the time you come out, not only have you kind of fostered that community again, but you also are set up to go get work. And so the chance of reoffending over there is really, really, really small. The way we do it, and this isn't, you know, again, being judgy, but it's like we've done this for a long, long time and it doesn't seem to be working. But to lock people up and then just, like you said, open the door, are you free now? The chance of that person going back into crime, into prostitution, into addiction, whatever it was that got him in there in the first place, is obviously going to be a lot higher if we haven't done anything inside to try and change that behavior.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think over here, there's like a small percentage of people that want to get help. Some people just don't care. I've recently experienced that. So, like I said, you've got to be willing to change.
Yeah, so let me ask you a question then, seeing because you got the two side by side. What are the things that the British prisons could learn about the Thai prison, if anything, and then vice versa?
That's absolutely fuck all.
That's a good answer.
Seriously, absolutely nothing. As for Thai prisons, sometimes it'd be in a prison in the UK thinking it'd be better off in a Thai prison the way it was, you know what I mean? In a sense, like, Thai prisons are all green and there's a lot of people and there's a lot of fucking violence at the same time, but you know where you're at. You know, and then you go to a UK prison, which is like a concrete jungle where people are smoking spice and cutting each other up, and you know, there's gang culture and suicide rates are high, and there's a lot of mental health, you know, it's all drug induced. There's a lot of bang up and lockdown and violence upon screws. You know, they take a fucking tough beating as well, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
They're subjected to a lot, you know, the workforce is quite small. So, you know, you've got to understand that there's a lot of, what I believe that the UK prison can learn is putting more money into kind of spending a lot more time on individuals, you know what I mean? Because I think, nah, what you're doing there is all this shit. You just want to pay the bills at the end of the month, you know, and it doesn't matter to you whether people get out and stay out, because if they did, then you wouldn't be in a job. So the more the merrier for them, know what I mean, in a sense.
Yeah, especially here, because a lot of our prisons are privately run too. So they're making a profit out of them, which is, I don't think, a very healthy way of doing that particular system.
Nah. It's just them. I think people are just... it's more like, you know... just lip service. It sounds great. We're doing this and we're doing that. Ah, you fuck. You're doing fuck all for people in there. You know what I mean? It angers me, really, because I know, you know, there's no meetings in there, and like, and there's no strong recovery. There's no way. Everything's got to go through details and you know security checks and gang culture, and fucking hell, there's people who just want to get the shit together and stop using drugs. There's many in there. I mean, but you're just feeding them methadone and you're feeding them kind of antipsychotics and sleepers just to keep them quiet. Well, that's just, you know, it's just a bit. There's an injustice within the justice service.
Yeah, I think, and the what I say again, I'm not in this realm at all. I'm a fireman, I'm a medic, and I'm in America now, so I'm not even back home. But what I see from the outside looking in is we don't fix this by locking everyone away. We don't fix this by arresting everyone. You know, for example, let's take weed, for example. You know, there are, we realize now, some incredibly powerful medicinal effects. Now, you know, dealing and all that stuff, that's a separate thing. But prostitution is another one. I mean, I personally have removed dead prostitutes from, or, you know, seen them in, you know, hotel rooms or dumpsters or whatever, because these poor women are having to be in the shadows to do what they do. And to me, we can fix these areas, whether it's the Portuguese drug system or, you know, legalizing, you know, certain things, marijuana, prostitution, that are way better than alcohol, which you and I can go down the offie right now and buy as much as we want. And then you fix it from there, and you fix it, you know, you fix families so they don't create addicts and, you know, thugs and all these other things. But just locking people that have screwed up away does not seem to work in America, in England, and all the other places in around the world that use that system. It just doesn't work.
It just, it keeps, look, some people need locking away. That's the be all and end all of it, because they're quite dangerous, you know, in society. You know, and there's some people that are locked up because, like, they can't cope with life, and there's some people locked up because they're in addiction. And, you know, there's a diverse bunch of people within the establishments in and around the world. There's a lot of innocent people as well. You know, people set up, you know, there's people that are just stupid and getting nicked on conspiracies and do things that talk themselves into sentences, you know what I mean? So there's a lot of reasons why people are locked up, and there's a lot of reasons why it doesn't work for a majority of them as well.
So yeah, just to underline something, in that Norwegian prison model, they have people that they lock away. Like you said, the real, you know, sociopaths, they are locked away in a prison just like, you know, the ones that are around the world. But like you said, it's the addicts and the other people that, you know, are not waking up every day saying, I'm going to go, you know, on a summer camp and murder a bunch of kids. They're just, you know, trying to feed their addiction or whatever it is. That's completely wrong as well. But there are other ways of changing that. And I think that what we also miss is, in my profession, we lose police officers every single day. I know London's had a bunch of them just stabbed recently. You know, prison guards, like you said, not only getting killed, but the suicide rates amongst them. So by fixing the system, the goal is to make it safer, not only for society, but also my peers as well, the men and women on the streets that are risking their lives trying to combat crime, so that now they can focus on the people that truly are dangerous to our society, instead of the addicts and, you know, the Johns and all these other people that are getting arrested and kind of diluting our prison system and our you know, police force as well.
Just a resource, aren't they? Just like, it's about kind of like alleviating the emergency service, because people are getting calls up for overdoses, this, that, and the other. It's you know, the emergency services are there for emergencies, not for fucking people who pick up drugs and want to overdose, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, and again, it boils down to, like we were saying before, the goal is for those toddlers to grow up and be happy, you know what I mean? And letting them grow up and be all disturbed and then trying to fix a problem is not the most effective way of doing it. But if we can address the addiction in the entire country at the ground level, that and then is going to affect the crime rate. Because as you were saying, you know, the reason why a lot of people are doing these things, even the gangs, it all boils down to money ultimately, you know, slinging dope and whatever else they're doing.
The reality is, James, you're never gonna be in a position to kind of like help everyone in addiction, even if you had the chance, because like I said, it's people can be tough customers, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I do, but I think that we can definitely improve the way we do it and reduce the amount of people. You're always going to have, you know, that group, but you know, if addicts, like you said, if addicts have a route to find help that's extremely easy versus a direct route to prison because they got caught with whatever on their possession, then I think that would be a great first step.
There's the opportunity for people to reduce, you know, addiction in the community. There's an opportunity for that. It's just having enough resources to show people that it does work and that there is a way out. And that's what I feel, you know, that it's important that I've got an opportunity, and I believe in me for a reason to share my experience with others and go, look, you know what, I've been through some fucking shit in my life. I mean, I've had cancer and meningitis, years in addiction, years in foreign prisons, years in prisons in the UK. And you know what? I've come out, I'm standing tall today and I don't use drugs. I don't want to use drugs. I don't have a desire to use any. I don't want to harm anyone. I just want to be of service to society. And I believe every addict feels the same.
Yeah, no, exactly. Well, let's talk about giving back. So one of the things you did was write the book and you know, tell your story. So where were you when you wrote the book? And then how did that become the film that we saw recently?
I was in Thailand in prison initially, and I was doing a journal, and I was writing bits and bobs down, and then I went to Wandsworth, and I got the chance to write in there. And then, you know, I got released, and I finished it, and then I sent it, submitted it to publishers. So I was on a different kind of, I was in, like, Thailand prisons, UK prisons, release, publish.
Brilliant. And how long from publishing it were you approached to make it into a film?
About a year.
Brilliant. Because it's just for everyone listening, if they haven't, so the book is A Prayer Before Dawn, the movie's the same title, but the book really kind of leads you down, you know, a good significant chunk of your life, certainly the Thai side. I actually ended up getting the audio book, so it was quite amusing. The guy that read that, his Thai voice was pretty pretty cool to hear. But then the movie, they chose to just focus on the actual incarceration, which I think is great, because some movies, you know, you read the book, you see the movie, sometimes it's, you know, it's not as good, or it tells exactly the same story. Like, well, that was basically the book. But this kind of gives you, you know, a snapshot of from the day you came in through what we've talked about till, you know, when they fictionally had your dad, aka you, show up at the very end.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. All right. Well, then let's talk about one more thing before we do some wrap up questions to close up. You are now, or you have written a second book. So do you have a title for that yet?
Yeah, it's called Surrender from the Heart, and it's a follow-up from A Prayer Before Dawn. And it kind of talks about the journey, you know, after being released, and you know what happened in between, and it's quite a sad story. It reflects as well on my past a little bit more in detail. It talks about the fall from grace, you know, standing on a red carpet to being in a crack den a couple of days later in Liverpool. You know what I mean? What happened?
So that was the movie was out. You were doing the promo, and then you found yourself back in addiction again.
Yeah, I found myself diagnosed with cancer, going through chemotherapy. You know, found myself in the criminal fraternity again, and doing things again that I didn't want to do. Just wondering what was going on with my life. Thought I was going to die. I just didn't care, you know, whether I did at the time. You know, I'm kind of really blessed and grateful, you know, that someone up there has been looking down on me and going, this guy has been through some fucking shit. Let's pull him out of it, and let's guide him and give him a bit of hope here and a chance to kind of, you know, have the opportunity to change other people's lives. You know what I mean? And that's what I want to do. I get messages from people that say, you know what, Bill, you're an inspiration, and it's amazing what you've been through, and, you know, it's given me hope. And, you know, after reading your book, you know, I've got myself into a rehab. I read it last night with some guy from the Philippines telling me how he's got himself into a rehab, and, you know, just after reading my story and watching my movie, and I'm thinking, wow, this just reaches far beyond just me here in Liverpool. It kind of travels worldwide, and people, you know, are inspired and get up. And I sometimes sit back and I sink into the sofa and think, these guys talking about me, and I think I don't acknowledge myself enough for it, really. You know what I mean? I think, yeah, you know, it's been tough, and that's how it's been, and, you know, go through it. And, you know, but the reality of it is, I fucking had to fight my way out of it, you know what I mean? I've had to kind of really Surrender, totally. And that's where the title came in for this new book, Surrender from the Heart, man. Just throw the towel in. Stop fighting, because me sit me. What's the reason for the title? Because what years ago, some guy said to me, Billy, do you know when we surrender from the heart, the war ends? And I thought, wow. That just had that was a statement and a half, you know what I mean? It was an impact. The war ends within. So, yeah, I've finished writing it. I'm just on the edits at the minute. I'm looking to submit it for publication. And I'm quite happy with the outcome of this story, to be fair.
Did you find it cathartic? Did you find it almost healing when you wrote your story down, actually got it kind of out of your brain and onto paper?
Yeah, and every time I write and put my thoughts and feelings down on paper, you know, I'm honest, I'm open about how I feel, and it's quite authentic, and I believe that's what sells the story. You know, I'm not someone who's kind of inventing a kind of character that's some tough customer, and he's an hard case, and he's bends and shell jaws, and you know, he can take life and whatever it throws at him on the chin. And it's not like that. It's definitely not like that. You know what I mean? It's like, whoa. I mean, only a few feelings here. I feel a bit vulnerable. I feel scared. I feel insecure. I'm quite sensitive when people say that. I get paranoid. I suffer with mental health. You know, I've had lows and highs, and I've suffered with depression. You know, but you know what? I'm going to struggle with a smile at the end of the day. And that's how I get through it.
Yeah. And one thing I've found from a lot of people that I've had on here that have been through some horrible stuff themselves, you know, a lot of them have actually been right there ready to take their own life. And one of the biggest things, the biggest common denominators I see with a lot of them who are doing really well now is just like you were saying, realizing that they can start helping other people, whether they came out of PTSD and now they're helping other veterans or soldiers, you know, firefighters, whatever it is, or addicts that come through and now they're helping with rehab programs. That giving back seems to be such a healing thing for that individual as well.
Yeah, and I didn't even know what these names meant, like PTSD. I thought that was something you bought in Subway. No, there was all these like names, ADHD and PTSD and COPD, and all this is attached to kind of like, you know, your mental health, you know what I mean? Yeah. And I've realised that, like, just giving a bit back and giving someone a little bit of hope and trying to inspire and ignite that hope within them, it's fucking rewarding, man. Wow, you know, when someone goes, thanks, Bill. That means it from the very depths of the soul. And you think, wow. Wow, that's just like, I sometimes think that, you know, that's worth more than gold. To see someone else come alive and change. Because that one person as an individual can have an impact on a number of lives in society, in the community, you know, worldwide. It's like, there's a ripple effect. My family, you know, they've all recovered because I've recovered. When I'm not in recovery and when I'm unwell, everyone else is paying a price. And it's I spend time with my brother, and, you know, and I spend time with my mum, and I spend time with close friends. You know, and that's something that, you know, we're only here for a few short decades and then we're gone. So, you know, let's utilize our time and for the greater good, be of service to, you know, others.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I really couldn't. I think that's the thing that I love about the people that I work with is fundamentally that's what they're trying to do too, whether they're, you know, firefighters or police officers or, you know, ER physicians. You know, people are trying to just make the world better. And like you said, if you've been through hell, and you've come out the other side, now it's time to tell your story and be that arm that reaches out to the other people that are struggling and to help them through.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Well, I want to transition to some closing questions. The first one I always ask, we talked about your books. Is there a book that you love to recommend to other people. It can be about what we talked about today or something completely different.
Is there a book? I've read one called Who Will... what's it called? Was it Gregory? Sandra Gregory? It's Sandra Gregory. I kind of liked it. It was the female version of being inside a prison in Bangkok. I think it was Forget You Had a Daughter. That's right. Forget You Had a Daughter by Sandra Gregory. I kind of enjoyed reading that. That was the last book I read.
Brilliant.
And it was like a female kind of version of my story.
Excellent. What about a movie and or a documentary that you love?
A movie that I love and I've always kind of felt this was one of my favourites was True Romance.
Great film. Gary Oldman as the White Rastafarian.
Yeah, Driscoll. Oh. That was brilliant, that one.
Yeah, it was. And then what about a documentary? You seen any of those that you love?
Documentaries, which... I'm quite into aliens and time travel, mate. And all that kind of movement, so... I don't really know of anyone kind of, like... I like the unknown, mate, you know, like... I like to think that there's something beyond just this living room I'm sitting in at the minute. So, as for documentaries, I think Professor Green is pretty good at what he does.
Professor Green, perfect. Mm-hmm. All right, then is there a person that you would recommend to come on this podcast to talk to the first responders and military of the world as a guest?
Yeah, me mum. No, let me think. Would you like me to name the people or?
Yeah, I mean, if you've got someone on top, yeah. I mean, even your mum, you say no, but I mean, the mother of someone who's gone through that trauma would probably be an interesting perspective in itself.
Yeah, she'd be good at it. Like, I kind of like to joke about it because I know she's a bit like, oh, I'm not doing that, I'm not doing this. So you always throw it in the middle of it all. And she kicks me under the table and goes, oh, I'm not doing that. But yeah, I know what, I tell you, there's a guy called Tim Morris who works in HMP Walton. He works on the radio show in there and, you know, he's changing lives while he's in there by giving... people the opportunity to get involved in that kind of industry and media stuff, you know what I mean, and finding the voice through radio. So yeah, I could speak to him and ask him would he be interested.
Yeah, absolutely. So he's a prisoner, but he's doing that project to try and...
No, he's a prison staff member.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I was just thinking, yeah, he's someone who could... You could do that, yeah, Mom.
Perfect.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you. So then the last one, before we talk about where we can find the book and the movie and people reach out to you, what do you do now to decompress, to kind of go to your happy place these days?
I teach young kids how to box. And it's the most wonderful, the most wonderful thing that I've ever done, you know, lately, which is like seeing someone else grow and develop.
Yeah. Do you find it kind of weird that you're in that spot that your boxing coach was when you were a kid?
Yeah. I do like, I'll, you know, once-on-ones and, you know, to give myself time to, not only young lads, but, you know, there's females and males that are interested in getting, you know, taught how to box and how to learn a little bit of Muay Thai and a few skills that I've learned over the years. And, you know, I offer, you know, my experience and teach them the best I can really and give them the time that I was given as a child, you know what I mean? And I think it's like sort of giving something back to society as a whole as well, you know what I mean? It's a one word. I like to kind of like write and relax and watch a few programs on the telly and, you know, spend a bit of time with my family, which is a lot at the minute.
Brilliant. Yeah, I had a guy called Pat Russo, who's a retired New York police officer, who started a kids boxing program, and you know, trying to get kids that are at risk off the streets and focused in boxing. And they even you know, offer them prizes if they get certain grades at school, and it's incredible. They've done so well, and in that area where this gym is, that again, the crime came down, the relationship with the police officers improved. So all it takes is members of the community to go outside their door and think of a way they can actually help their neighbors around them and start fixing the country themselves.
Yeah, definitely, Mum.
Brilliant. All right. So then to finish, where can people find the books, the movie, and how can they reach out to you if they were wanting to talk?
Well, you can get me on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram. There's the usual social media sites. My email's also, you know, displays on my Twitter account. The book you can get on Amazon. You can get the movie on Sky On Demand, iTunes, Google. You can contact Maverick House Publishers, who supply the book as well. That's available on there. And it should be on Netflix pretty soon. I'm supposed to be distributed, and he said, you know, Netflix will be, so it'll have a broader audience in the UK.
Yeah, well, it is right now. In America, it's on Netflix at the moment. That's where I watched it.
Yeah, well, it's not on over here yet, so you got all the minge bags downloading it. And then asking me, how much you're making? And I'm thinking, well, I'm not making nothing if you're downloading it for free. Well, like, I'm guilty of doing that myself, so you might have kind of, you know what I mean? I'm
yeah.
self-righteous in that area. I'm quite... It doesn't really matter, as long as, you know, if you like it and you enjoy it and it is what it is, then yeah, fine, fair enough, it is what it is.
Yeah, well, like we were talking before, though, hopefully, you know, the new project, the Surrender From The Heart, you know, you're going to have your hands on the reins a little bit more, and, you know, I hope that that will be the next, you know, platform for you. And like you said, now you're in this space where you're wanting the help, and I think that's gonna pay dividends in a currency greater than money.
Yeah. Money's just material. You know, like I said before, we're only here for a few short decades. You know, let's make it worthwhile. Let's take care of your mum and take care of your family and be a, you know, a good husband or a good boyfriend, or be kind to someone, just be nice. You know, it ain't going to be like that all the time, because you're going to have your own moments, but, you know, it's just about, like, believing that, you know, there's good around you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you know what, James, I really appreciate your time, and, you know, and I apologize for the delay in, you know, this interview, because I've been wanting to do it for quite some time, and things have come up, and I haven't had the opportunity to do it. But you know what, I'm really grateful for your time. You know, and it's not just about me and you interviewing me. It's a pleasure to be interviewed by you, and I've quite enjoyed that. And, you know, and I wish you well in all that you do, to be honest.
Well, thank you so much. And I'm glad that we did delay, because I think, you know, finding you where you are now is a great place. And now you can reflect on, you know, where you were before. So I think this was the perfect time to do it. So I just thank you so much for taking the time to talk. And, you know, I hope we talk again soon one day.
Oh, definitely. Thanks.